morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, April 9th, 2019. The time is 9:02 a.m. We are meeting in the Senate Finance Room in the State Capitol. Please silence your cell phones. This is Co-Chair Natasha Von Imhoff, and I'm joined today by Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Machicki. We also have President Giesel joining us today. We have a quorum to do business. On today's agenda, we have SB 43, Extend Big Game Commercial Services Board, SB 44, Telehealth, Physician Assistance and Drugs, SB 93, Medical Provider Incentives and Loan Repayment. I'd like to direct members' attention to our first bill, Senate Bill 43, an act extending the termination date of the Big Game Commercial Services Board and providing for an effective date. Senate Finance first heard this bill on March 13, 2019, and held a second hearing on March 27, 2019, to further discuss the investigation process and disciplinary actions by the board. There is a committee substitute for consideration. Senator Wilikowski, can I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 43, version 31-LS0442/M before the committee as our working document.
Thank you. I will object for the purposes of discussion and ask my staff, Julie Lucky, to explain the changes in the CS.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky, and I am staff to Senator Von Imhoff. The committee members should have received the proposed CS, version M, and an explanation of changes, which I'll be using to explain the CS today. When the committee first saw the bill, it was just a two-section bill, which had an extension date to 2025 and an immediate effective date. In the CS, the extension date has been reduced 1 year to 2024, and then you'll see that in Section 1. We've also added Section 2, which simply adds the word hold on page 1, line 11, to AS 0854605, and the effect of that would be to allow an immediate suspension, the board to immediately suspend a license for the same reasons that the board can currently withhold or not renew a license. Section 3 has also been added, and Section 3 increases minimum qualifications for a master guide outfitter license, and you'll see those changes on page 2, lines 26, page 2, lines 29, and line 31. And then continuing with the addition of subsection 4 on page 3, on lines 2 through 5, and this was a concern that the committee had that a master guide outfitter license could not be withheld for someone that had a hunting violation or a transportation services violation. And so this addition of subsection 4 would allow the board to withhold that master guide outfitter license if somebody has a history of violations. Section 4 was also added, and this is all new language. And this would allow the board to revoke a master guide outfitter license in certain circumstances. And that is all of the changes in the CS, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. I would like the record to state that Senator Schauer has joined us. Are there any questions on the CS by committee members? I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to the adoption of the CS? Seeing no objection, the CS is adopted. Is there any further committee discussion on the bill or on the CS? We do have people in the chambers available for questions. Sarah Chambers, Mr. Henry Tiffany, the chairman of the Big Game Commercial Services, as well as Mr. Greg Francois with professional licensing. Okay, I don't see any questions. Senator Wilikowski, can I have a motion to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move Senate Finance Committee substitute for Senate Bill 43, version 31-LS0442/M from committee with the forthcoming fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving the bill from the committee? Seeing no objection, the bill moves from committee. Members, please be sure to sign the committee report. Before we move on to the next item, I wanted to let the audience or the committee know that we are working with Chris Curtis on a special audit request regarding investigations. My staff will be distributing the request for comments soon. Next, I would like to direct members' attention to CS for Senate Bill number 44, an act relating to the prescription of drugs by a physician assistant without physical examination and providing for an effective date. And I'd like to invite Senator Kathy Geisel and her staff, Jane Conway, to present the bill. Please identify yourselves for the record and begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Kathy Geisel, representing Senate District N. Madam Chairman, the Senate Bill 44 is a cleanup bill. Basically cleans up an issue related to some legislation passed several years ago. The goal of the bill is to increase access to medical and behavioral health in Alaska. In 2016, the Medicaid Reform Bill, that was Senate Bill 74, revised Alaska statutes and issued issued the allowance for the State Medical Board to issue guidelines allowing physicians to render a diagnosis, provide treatment, or prescribe, dispense, or administer a prescription drug to a person without conducting a physical examination. In other words, allowed them to practice telemedicine. However, Senate Bill 74 specifically addressed only physicians. Therefore, the State Medical Board made the assumption that because there was not evidence of legislative intent in Senate Bill 74, there was no provision to allow physician assistants to also participate in telemedicine. Parenthetically, I would just add, Madam Chair, there was in fact intent that physician assistants be included. However, it wasn't clearly articulated. First, let me also just let committee members know, as well as the public, what a physician assistant is. During the Vietnam War, military medics in the war theater were called upon to perform urgent, complex, and life-saving medical treatment. When the war ended, these veterans returned home with tremendous medical knowledge and skills. The physician assistant position came into existence to utilize these skills and to extend them into the family practice and specialty medical field by allowing physician assistants to work in physicians' offices. In your packet, you'll find a document from the American Academy of Physician Assistants. It outlines the education and experience required to be qualified as a physician assistant. Their education includes taking medical histories, doing physical exams, lab testing, prescribing medications, etc. Typically, their education is 27 months long. They do the usual medical rotations of medical and surgical, as well as family and internal medicine, pediatrics, obstetrics, emergency medicine, and psychiatry. They complete at least 2,000 hours of supervised clinical practice. Almost all physician assistant education programs are now master's degrees, and by 2020, they will be required to be master's degrees. The State Medical Board guidelines for PAs are also in your packet. It outlines the requirement for a collaborative practice agreement that they must maintain with their physician supervisor. That collaborating physician authorizes where the PA practices and what their functions involve and what prescriptions, what medications they can prescribe. It also requires monthly supervision, some kind of monthly contact with their supervising physician. In Alaska, physician assistants are also authorized to prescribe controlled substances, Schedule 2 through 5. In your packet, there's a summary of what those specific medications are. Because telemedicine only allowed physicians to perform, because telemedicine in the Medicaid Reform Bill only allowed physicians to perform that function, the State Medical Board has not allowed this authorization for PAs. This led to PAs being subject to the limitation that was prior affecting physicians. That is, they could not treat a patient via telemedicine without first conducting an in-person examination personally, or the examination being done by a collaborating physician or other practitioner in the same group practice. So extremely restricted, Madam Chair. So Senate Bill 44 will allow the approximately 700 licensed physician assistants in Alaska to provide telemedicine in the same manner physicians do. They were actually able to do this prior to Senate Bill 74, Madam Chair. Sometimes the specific bills we pass have negative consequences on people who are already doing a certain function if it's not spelled out in the new bill that we pass. So basically, this will benefit all Alaskans who will have increased access to health care, particularly in rural and medically underserved areas. So in your packet, you'll find a map from the Health Resources and Services Administration, otherwise called HRSA, which identifies the professional shortage areas and underserved areas of Alaska. You'll see that most of Alaska qualifies in those categories. In your packet, you'll also find letters from physician assistants who practice in rural Alaska. They articulate the importance of correcting this oversight in the law. The State Medical Board has taken a neutral position on this piece of legislation. Madam Chair, my staff, Jane Conway, is here to go over a sectional, and I know that there are a number of physician assistants and physicians who have called in to speak on this subject. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, President Giesel. Are there any questions on the intent of the bill for the sponsor?
Not,
Senator Schauer.
Not intent, but just another question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Giesel, I'm just curious because looking at this, it seems like that this would potentially help drive down some cost as well, just because you don't necessarily have to drive visits to offices down the road. You could even see, you know, less overhead and other things. So is the potential with this as well, and I know that's not the driver, it was about service, but could this help lower some of the costs that we would incur by forcing people to either travel to get the care or to have to show up at doctor's offices when it could be taken via phone call?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, absolutely, particularly for recheck visits, behavioral health. A lot of times, certainly in rural Alaska, behavioral health therapists and physician assistants are not nearby to provide those services. Absolutely helps reduce costs.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Any further questions by the committee? Seeing none. Ms. Conway, could you please review the sectional analysis?
Good morning. I'm Jane Conway, staff to Senator Kathy Giesel. We have five sections in this bill. Section 1 amends AS 0864-101A6, which is the governing statute of duties of the board, requiring the board to adopt regulations for a physician assistant practicing telehealth, and that the regulations must use a national model for standards of telehealth care. And in Section 2, it amends 0864-364A, which is the statute of prescribing of drugs without a physical examination, saying that disciplinary action cannot be directed towards a physician assistant for prescribing drugs via telehealth if the drugs are not controlled substances, if follow-up care can be provided from the medical group, and if consent has been given by the patient, and there will be sharing of records through the primary care provider. And Section 3 amends 0864-364B by saying that a physician assistant may administer botulinum toxin, otherwise known as Botox, if they meet all the requirements set out in 0864-36, and that should be 3. I saw a little typo that I made. That's the statute that governs the maximum dosage for opioids. And if that must be supervised by an appropriate licensed health care provider in that instance. And Section 4 amends 0864-364 again by renumbering and adds that a physician or a physician assistant may not prescribe, dispense, or administer a prescription drug via an internet questionnaire or perhaps an email message without having a prior relationship with that patient. Section 5 provides for an effective date.
Are there any questions regarding the sectional? Senator Wilikowski, followed by Senator Schauer, then Bishop.
Thank you. In section 2 and section 3, you're changing patient to person. And what is the rationale for that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe patient is a medical terminology. Person is a legal terminology, which is the terminology the drafter chose to use in this instance. And if maybe Senator Giesel has another perspective on that. Nope, that's good. Okay.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, when you said it's Section 3, where it reads, are met and a physician or physician assistant prescribes, dispenses, or administers the controlled substance or botulinum toxin when an appropriate licensed healthcare provider, et cetera, why did you have to spell out botulinum toxin specifically, and how does that break itself out from the other drugs that would be prescribed as controlled?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, that was existing statute, and I believe that it is called out because at the time that statute was written, as now, it's a significant medication. I mean, it's a paralytic agent. And so it was called out along with controlled substances as something that a person would have to have authorization to prescribe and administer.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Bishop.
Senator Schauer asked my question. Thank you.
The question that I have is on Section 5. Why was that effective date chosen?
Madam Chair, we consulted with Sarah Chambers with licensing, and she thought that would be a reasonable time frame that they would be able to get the regulations done. Most likely they would be done January of 2020, but this was her recommendation.
Thank you. Are there any further questions by the committee? Okay, so no further questions. I would like to open public testimony. I see one person online. So I'm going to open up public testimony. I see Mr. Christopher Deitch with Orion Behavioral Health Network has signed up for public testimony. Mr. Deitch, if you could state your name for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Sure. Hi, my name is Christopher Dietrich. So that's Dietrich, not Deitch. But I'm a PA working in Alaska. I practice child and adolescent psychiatry throughout Alaska from Kotzebue to Ketchikan. I also practice in another underserved population demographic with the Department of Corrections. As I wear many hats in the field of telemedicine, I'm also president of the Alaska Collaborative of Telemedicine Telehealth. This is a nonprofit group that provides advocacy to decrease barriers for patients throughout Alaska. I'm advocating today for the support of SB 44, and in particular advocating such to decrease barriers for my patients in rural Alaska. This bill does not change my scope of practice and my ability to treat established patients via telemedicine. This bill makes the initial contact easier for my patients to have adequate treatment. The bill eliminates the unnecessary barrier for a face-to-face exam to establish a relationship with patients. One example of how this hinders care, if I have a patient who is discharged from the hospital with medication, they may return to a village, such as St. Michael or its sister Stebbins. The delay in an adequate evaluation may then may take months before they can be seen in person. If the patient is not able to continue their prescription or be adequately monitored, this could have severe concerns, and unfortunately, suicide is one of them. Thank you for allowing me to give public testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Is there anybody else signed up online for public testimony? Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing and hearing none, public testimony is closed. So we do have available in the room Ms. Sarah Chambers, Director, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing, and online Deborah Stovern, the Executive Director of the State Medical Board. Does the committee have any further questions on this bill? Senator Wilkowski.
I need to understand Section 4 a little better, and I don't know who might be available to explain that to me, particularly C1. We're changing an or to an and when prescribing, dispensing, or administering abortion-inducing drugs.
So, Senator Geisel, if you'd like to answer that, you can call a lifeline as necessary.
Madam Chair, I believe Deborah Stovern, she is the executive director of the State Medical Board, is online and could probably direct the answer to that question.
Thank you, Senator Geisel. So, Ms. Stovern, did you hear Senator Wilikowski's question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Deborah Stovern. I'm with the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. As stated, I am the Executive Administrator for the State Medical Board. As I understand the question, it is the change from or to and under Section 4, and or maybe why we're including these two items as a limitation. I don't know the answer to the question for the change from or to and, other than perhaps it was a drafter's decision to make sure that both are prohibited or limited, both items, one and two. That would be, I'm sorry, my best guess. I believe that both of these items were included in the original legislation that was discussed by Senator Geisel under Senate Bill 74 as being appropriate limitations to the practice of telemedicine. And the only other change that I think is occurring in this bill is adding physician assistant to the limitation that already applies to a physician.
Senator Wilikowski, do you have a follow-up?
No, I'm just trying to understand what that section does, but I can look some more into it offline.
So we are setting this bill aside today, and we can explore other areas. If you don't have questions now, you can bring questions to my office at a later date once you've had time to digest it. Thank you, Ms. Stovern. Do we have any further questions by committee members? Okay. So seeing none at this point, we're going to move on just to read the fiscal notes. Senator Machicki, could you please review the fiscal note?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Fiscal note review for the previous number one and number two that are in your packets. Number one is Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development Appropriation, Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. Allocation is Corporations and Business Professional Licensing. OMB component number is 2360. The impact for FY20 is $5,300. And in out years, it's zero in out years. If the bill passes, the division will require $5,300 to cover the legal costs and amend regulations, printing, and postage in the first year. And remember, these are receipt services. The licensing fees are paid by the those that are licensed. The number two department is Department of Administration. The appropriation is centralized admin services. The allocation is health plans administration. The OMB component number is 2152. The impact is zero.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. We will set this bill aside for further review, and to respond to Senator Wilikowski's question, we will get with legal to clarify the verbiage and the words chosen for Section 4. Please also let my office know as soon as possible if you have any concerns or amendments to this bill. So we are going to take a brief at ease for this next bill while the presentation is set up. Thank you. We are back on the record. I'd like to direct members' attention to CS for Senate Bill number 93, an act relating to a workforce enhancement program for healthcare professionals employed in the state and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Senator David Wilson and Jill Lewis, Deputy Director, Division of Public Health, to present the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is David Wilson, Senator for District 3, and with me is Ms. Jill Lewis, the Deputy Director of the Department of Health and Social Services, Public Health. Thank you for hearing today Senate Bill 93, Medical Provider Incentive Loan Repayments today. I'll give a brief overview of the bill. If it pleases the committee, a quick sexual analysis. And then Deputy Director Lewis will present the bill, a quick presentation, and talk to the note to the bill and provide some details of the challenges that currently exist. And also here is one of our lifelines, is Rachel Gearhart, is the co-chair of the Sharp Advisory Council. Senate Bill 93 builds upon the success of the Healthcare Professional Loan Repayment Incentive Program, commonly known as the SHARP program. Urban and rural Alaskan communities have faced a series of shortages of healthcare providers. If not immediately addressed, this shortage will rapidly worsen. The SHARP is a loan repayment program, that direct monetary incentive program that helps reduce these shortages by filling vacant healthcare provider positions in some of the most underserved areas across our great state. The SHARP 1 and SHARP 2 leverage federal, state, and mental health trust authority and employer funding, which will focus on rural Alaska and our safety net providers. To date, this program, SHARP 1 and SHARP 2, which is administered by the Department of Health and Social Services, has supported more than 250 practitioners in nearly 60 sites across this great state. SHARP 3, which we commonly refer to in our office as Baby SHARP, fills the gap between the federally SHARP program 1 and the state-funded SHARP 2 program by providing private sponsorship in the form of local government and philanthropical foundation and employers and employer support. SHARP 3 focuses on private and public partnerships, recruitment retention by offering incentives to the newly experienced professionals who exhausted all other loan repayment options which are no longer able to carry educational loan debt. These professionals must meet eligibility criteria and be encouraged to and engage in qualified employment. The program does not require any state general funds. User fees cover the costs of the program and the program administration. SHARP 3 is a budget neutral initiative that will address the service shortage areas in our state of in our healthcare landscape, leverages community level investment across the state, and improves our healthcare outcomes. Before I can go through a quick sexual analysis, Madam Chair.
Did you want to go through the sexual analysis prior to the PowerPoint?
We can cover that after the PowerPoint, if that's the wish of the committee.
Let's go through the PowerPoint right now, because I think that will give people a broader sense of what the bill is about. Please.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Alaska Division of Public Health. Test my ability to drive the PowerPoint. SB 93 addresses that worsening shortage of healthcare professionals in Alaska by establishing a healthcare professionals workforce enhancement program, or what we refer to as SHARP 3. The program is one in which healthcare professionals agree to work for 3 years in underserved areas in exchange for repayment of their student loans or direct incentives. Employers will fully fund the program, taking advantage of a federal tax exemption that's available only to a state-run program. This public-private partnership, such as this, increases the number of providers while minimizing the use of state funds. Healthcare is one of the largest and most dynamic industries in Alaska, yet many citizens, especially in rural and frontier areas, continue to experience challenges with accessing care. The availability of healthcare services is important for maintaining health, preventing and managing disease, reducing costs from unnecessary emergency room use, hospital readmissions, and temporary staffing costs One reason access to care is limited, particularly in rural Alaska, is due to the shortages of healthcare professionals. To meet the ongoing demand, the state must continue to address the shortage. Healthcare sites struggle with recruiting and retaining healthcare professionals. Healthcare professionals have challenges with large student loan debt, high cost of living in rural and remote locations, and the resulting financial pressures. SB 93 addresses these issues. I'd like to take a moment now to sort of review this current state-run program that we have had, which is called SHARP 2. The success of healthcare loan repayment and incentive programs in increasing healthcare workforce has been demonstrated by both our SHARP 1, which is a federal program, and SHARP 2. SHARP 2 operated from 2013 to 2018. However, after 2015, we were not able to issue any more new contracts because of GF budget reductions. During that period, we issued 83 contracts for SHARP 2, 39 in Tier 1 and 44 in Tier 2, and I'll explain the tiers in just a moment. Roughly half of the positions were what we consider very hard to fill. Those have a demonstrated difficulty in recruitment. The average payment per contract was about $25,000 per year for each of the contract years. Employers contributed between 10 and 30% of the cost, and the rest was state UGF. Altogether, there were about 31 employers in 25 different communities that participated in the program. Most of those were nonprofits and hospitals. About half were tribal and non-tribal, and there was distribution across all of the areas of the state, although obviously not evenly distributed across there. This program, SHARP 2, is scheduled to sunset June 30th of this year. The federally funded SHARP 1 option is not going to be affected by SHARP 2 sunsetting or by SB 93. That program will continue. With the sunset of SHARP 2, other healthcare practitioner incentive programs are needed so that we can continue to reduce the workforce shortages throughout the state. SB 93 builds on the success that we have had so far with SHARP 1 and 2, but expands to new practice settings, new occupations, new employers, new locations, and new roles to meet the increasing demand. The benefit won't be limited to just rural Alaska. It will be, there's room for urban healthcare professionals. It won't be just primary care. It will also allow for specialties. This is what we would call a win-win situation, an opportunity. Employers get to hire much needed staff. The healthcare professionals get assistance with their loan payments, which makes it much more affordable to work in a rural community. And Alaskans that live in rural communities have improved access to healthcare, and all of that without the use of undesignated general funds. So now I'd like to take a few minutes and just go over some of the nuts and bolts of how the SHARP 3 program is going to work. Healthcare professionals apply to join the SHARP 3 program, and they choose whether they want to get student loan repayment or a direct incentive or a combination of both. They agree to work in underserved and shortage areas for 3 years. They may renew their contract up to 3 times for 3 years apiece, which is a 12-year lifetime limit. The employer sites are places that serve underserved populations like the uninsured, Medicaid, Medicare, Indian Health Services, or they may be in health shortage areas. The employer's payments that they give to the state, they fully cover the cost of the healthcare professional's contract, and they also provide an administrative fee that will cover the cost to run the program. So it truly does not cost the state anything to operate. We have a long-standing advisory council who will continue to recommend the criteria that we use for to determine eligibility, prioritize which sites and which professionals will best serve and meet the shortage areas, and help us determine what the contract awards will be. There are three different tiers with different payment maximums that healthcare professionals can have. Tier 1 and Tier 2 exist in Sharp 1 and Sharp 2 and are similar but have some differences in which precise occupations they cover. Tier 3 is brand new with this bill and is a novel innovation. Tier 1 are dentists, pharmacists, and physicians. They can get $35,000 per year, or if they're in a very hard-to-fill position, then they can have a 35% premium. Tier 2 is a lot of the licensed occupations that require a master's degree level, registered nurses, APRNs, physician assistants, psychologists, counselors, et cetera.
We actually have a question here, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a very clear-cut criteria for hard to fill? Can you, you sort of talked about that, but is it kind of a black and white line?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, very hard to fill is defined in our current regulations. It's a part of the Sharp 2 program. Very hard to fill requires documentation by the employer that the position has been vacant for a year, and they also have to demonstrate how actively they have recruited for it. They also, if they have had interviews, they have to produce evidence of the interviews they've had and why those people were not appropriate. So there's quite a few standards and criteria for what that means.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Lewis, as you look at some of the shortage areas that you've addressed, are what percentage is there between the rural areas, which we all assume that that's going to be there, but as opposed to inner city where you can't, it's very difficult to fill some of those neighborhood clinics that are out there?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Olson. That difficulty that particularly affects urban areas and the knowledge that a lot of the healthcare in our state is served in kind of a hub and spoke model. So you do have concentrations in the more urban areas of the physicians who actually serve the rural. The Sharp 1 program as a federal program is very narrow and doesn't allow for that. The Sharp 2 program expanded on that, but we found a significant amount of geographic restrictions that we still weren't able to do. But this Sharp 3, we will be able to open it up far more to urban areas as well as rural, and not just primary care, which has been the focus of the other programs, but also for specialties, which are in dire need in this state but have never had an incentive program before.
Madam Chair, if I could continue.
Senator Olson, follow
up. I'm assuming that inner cities do qualify for being underserved as well.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's true. There's healthcare shortages in individual occupations. There might not be a dermatologist or something like that. So we look at it very granularly. And in underserved areas, the employers have to provide care to underserved populations. The current definition of that is 30% of their population is underserved, underserved being uninsured or under a public program like Medicaid.
Madam Chair, the other question I have is that on slide 4, you've got Gulf Coast as well as Anchorage and Matsu both making up roughly 30% of what's going to happen there. What's the distinct what's the difference between Gulf Coast versus Anchorage and Mat-Su? Bottom page four.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure I understand your question about what the difference is.
Because there's such a large percentage compared to, say, Interior and Northern, which is 3%, of the Gulf Coast being 12%, you look at the Southeast is covered at 28, Southwest is covered at 27, you got Anchorage and Mat-Su at 18. I'm assuming that'd be the Gulf of Alaska, but I guess I was wondering what the definition of that Gulf Coast that's getting 12% of the organization.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think I understand your question. The Gulf Coast is part of the, like around Kodiak and, you know, Dillingham and those areas through there, and the Kenai. It would be through that area.
No further question, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, and in the final report to the legislature from the SHARP 2 program that came out in December of 18, to help with Senator Olson's question earlier, Anchorage only had 2 behavioral health, 4 dentists, and only 2 medical, where compared to the Gulf Coast had 2 behavioral health and 8 medical. Southeast had 15 medical providers, and Southwest had 13 medical providers. And so it is truly for those underserved populations compared to where Anchorage and Mat-Su. Mat-Su only had 2 behavioral health, 2 dental, and 3 medical providers. So the medical providers that most likely are qualifying for these are for those safety net providers like the federally qualified health centers, which we have in, we have 2 in the Mat-Su area and the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center in Anchorage.
Were those vacancies, Senator Wilson, that you were citing?
No, these are the actual people who are participating, who participated in the SHARP 2 program.
Okay. Senator Schauer, you had a question.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions. The hub and spoke model you mentioned a little bit, that's obviously there's sometimes, especially in Alaska, we saw like with troopers, that's a tough one when you're sending people about and back. There's travel costs that get associated with that. And that gets tough at times for, you know, the doctors, physicians, et cetera, that would have to travel and do this. So have you, as they've looked at that, do you have any information that shows that hub and spoke model it has been working, is going to work? And then it sounds like it's covered, but I'm going to ask for the record, because if you go to very hard to fill positions, obviously the cost jumps up dramatically. If it was a lot of very hard to fill versus hard to fill, is there any portion of this that the state might end up having to pay to make that work, or is it truly going to be covered by the cost of the employers as you go out there? So just kind of those two things in general. Thanks.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I will try and address the hub and spoke issue. That has been a model that Alaska has used for a great deal of its health care for a long time. Telehealth certainly expands on that and limits the need to actually travel, because the spoke can get services from the hub without the travel. So there are ways that technology is helping us with that to keep the cost down. And you're very correct that it is wearing on physicians to have to travel out constantly, or for the patients to have to travel in. And so it's a long-standing way of doing it. A lot of the areas of the state wouldn't necessarily support having all of the different specialties in particular, and it makes more sense to keep them in a hub area where there is, you know, enough volume to create a full practice. So I'm not sure if I addressed your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You did, basically. And then the second part of it was just for the record, because it sounds like it is, but I want to make it, like I said, just official, if you will, that the program, when you look for those very hard-to-fill positions, because that can be tough. I know we have a town in my district, Valdez, has asked specifically about this program because they're having a hard time getting and keeping their clinic filled with the appropriate people they need for the 4,000 folks that live there. They're out their ways, even though they're on the road system. So is that something that the state would ever have to pick up as this is written, or is this bill truly going to ensure that the employers are always going to pick up the cost regardless of the travel incurred, of the very hard-to-fill positions, et cetera? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Schauer, SHARP 3 uses no state funds. 100% of the funding is provided by the employers. And you might wonder why they would want to do that. They certainly can do this on their own. It's a voluntary program. But if they go through the state-run program, the state is a state-run program allows the healthcare practitioner's loan repayment to be exempt from federal income tax, which is a huge boon to the individual professional, but it also reduces the cost for the employer because the employer would otherwise have to spend more money to give the same level of incentive to the professional. So it's something that they're really anxious to do, and the employers would pay all of the funds.
So, Senator Wilson, did you want to add anything to that before Senator Schauer asks his follow-up?
No, Madam Chair. I was just going to give sort of an overview of sort of like a hub-and-spoke model, which I know the YK Delta uses with the UConn Kuskokwim Health Corporation. They have a Wayne Main Hospital in Bethel, and they have sub-regional clinics that are dispersed out throughout the area. And in those sub-regional areas, they also have smaller clinics as well. And it's all under one entity, one chain, so the services are a little bit is different than just going from separate clinics. They're all one entity providing sort of that hub and spoke model within that. So you have sort of three different levels of tier of health services that those health professionals can thus travel to and provide with have different levels of specialties from your community health aides all the way up to a mid-level practitioner, all the way up to a physician.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Senator Schauer, a follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last one, I promise. Hub and spoke, it's inefficient. I don't have a great answer for how you get around that in the state because we have distances involved and small communities spread out, so there's going to be cost involved. I get it, but this is still urban-centered where the volume, you said, is. So that's a problem we face. I'm just trying to chew on how you get around that to try to make it better, more efficient. And this follow-on question, specifically for you, Senator Wilson, I think, is – and it may be completely separate, but you're talking about employers paying, you know, the loan repayment, et cetera. Has anybody looked at how we might tie WAMI into this because we're trying to get our doctors and how there might be some synergies we could do between that program trying to get the doctors trained up here and have them tied into this somehow? And they may be separate, but we're trying to keep that program going, and we need doctors. So I don't know, just a thought.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I will attempt to address the WAMI issue. I am not an expert in how WAMI operates. There is more than one underlying reason why we have healthcare shortages. Part of it is attracting folks to the rural areas and having them commit to stay for a period of time to provide that care. But we also, you know, don't train our own healthcare professionals in all areas, especially the physicians and the dentists. So we need both streams. We need to have new trained professionals because until there are trained professionals, then they wouldn't be able to offer any practice. Folks who have gone through WAMI and have loan repayment, they can qualify for SHARP once they are fully trained and in practice. And so there is some linkage there where they can work together to incentivize folks to stay in the state.
Thank you. It is a positive direction that in certain sectors where it makes sense, the private sector is coming up with innovative ways to help fund programs that are important to them. There are separate conversations going on with WAMI in regards to addressing the $3 million a year. We can talk about that another time. We're going to stick with the bill that we have in front of us, but I do appreciate the link, Senator Schauer, and that, again, not across the board will private sector step into public services because generally it's not profitable to do so, but to help offset some of the costs where it does make sense in high need area, it is refreshing to see efforts occurring at this time. So Thank you. I believe that we left on slide 8, if you would like to continue. Except we have Senator Machicki has a question.
Yeah, and I hope you didn't cover this, but I think this is a clear example of DGF that adds to the budget, except it doesn't. And I think we have to explain that to folks. When we keep pushing back on the DGF being included as one big lump, this is the case where outside money is funding something from the private sector because they're interested in contributing and the state helping to provide a service, yet it's at no cost to the state. It looks like it's a part of the budget, but it actually isn't. It's covered, the costs are covered from outside of the state's responsibility. So it's innovative, but extremely important, and I hope to see more of this.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. When Senator Stedman reviews the fiscal note today, he can certainly bring that forward. So we're on slide 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we left off with Tier 2, and Tier 3 is a new innovation. What we have heard over and over again from the healthcare industry is that Tier 1 and Tier 2 just don't reach everywhere that we need to go, and because there's a specific list of occupations in Tier 1 and 2, we're missing out on certain ones that need to be incentivized and are difficult to fill. So Tier 3 allows us for positions that are not otherwise eligible. It is broad. It's intentionally broad. It would include things like drug and alcohol counselors, pathologists, radiologic technologists, infection prevention specialists that work in hospitals, care coordinators, and a host of other types of professionals that are necessary and important for in order to have healthcare delivered, including faculty, directors, and administrators who may have student loans and need student loan repayment. So if an entity needed a chief financial officer and they wanted to incentivize them, that's something that's possible under this program. The council will set the priorities and will assure that when someone offers, makes a suggestion and applies, when an employer applies for getting loan repayment for one of their employees, that is in fact addressing a shortage need that we have, and that will be a role that they continue to play. So I will walk briefly through the process of how this works. On slide 9, I will start at the top and work around. First, the healthcare professionals, they work for a quarter at a site that has already applied for and is an eligible site. They are an employee of that employer. The sites then report after the end of the quarter to the SHARP program on how many hours that professional worked. Then the SHARP program will adjust the maximum payment amount for the actual hours worked for that professional. Then the SHARP program will send an invoice to the employer site that will include the amount for their adjusted program payment, but also the administrative fee. The site will then send us a check, send back to the state a check with their quarterly payment. We will turn around and make the loan payment to a lender. It doesn't go to the employee, but if they have a direct incentive, that does go to the employee. And then the SHARP program provides data to the advisory council so that they can evaluate and plan and prioritize as they continue on their way. And that is kind of the process.
Senator Machicki has a question.
Yes, thank you. Does an employer have to register in advance as being a member of SHARP, or is it open to all healthcare employers?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the eligible sites have to provide care to the underserved population in a state-designated shortage area that will be defined in regulation. And so all employers are not eligible, but many, many are. And they do need to fill out an application. There is an employer application. There is also a health professional's application. And so each of them can apply separately, and then find each other, if you will. And a health professional who's looking for loan repayment would look for who is an eligible site, so they would like to get employment there.
Follow up? And then that employer is not charged unless they bring on one of those individuals as an employee, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that's correct. There is no cost until after the health professional has already provided a quarter of care, and then there is a bill.
Any further questions? Please continue.
So in closing, SB 93 will help keep healthcare professionals in the state, especially in rural communities. It will promote health and economic community stability and ensure a healthier future for all Alaskans at the lowest possible cost.
Thank you. Before we move on to the sectional, I see Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you look at the student loan repayment program that's there, how do you qualify for that student loan repayment? Because there are some people that have financed their education by actually going to a commercial institution and gotten loans from the bank to go ahead and either supplement or to go ahead and make sure they're all their scholastic bills get paid. Are commercial loans also included in this that would be repaid by the 93?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, commercial loans are included. Most student loan types would be included.
Give me an example of what's not included.
A loan from your grandmother.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
Thank you. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for the bill sponsor, and it's more on the 30,000 foot view. How come this, do we need this statute for this to take place? In other words, to give the authority for providers, the employers to do this? Is this something they could do on their own? So, and that's why I said this is a more general question, because you had a federal program, you had a state program, which is sunsetting. And it's like we're allowing them to. This is something they could do on their own, correct? Or do they have to have statutory authority? And I'm not trying to say like we don't need the bill. My question is, how come this isn't something that would happen on its own? Or is there statutory authority required? Or are we trying to basically make them go to the rural area? So why is government getting involved, I guess, is the question, to make it happen?
So through the chair, Senator Schauer, we saw this as a truly private public partnership where, yes, employers can do this on their own, but they would not receive some of the federal tax benefits as going through the state of Alaska. And if going through the state of Alaska, we wanted to try to find their biggest bang for their buck and making sure that they're going to the underserved areas to provide those, to have those providers provide service to those geographical areas that are harder to fill. It truly is that area. I mean, that's pretty much goal of this bill is to try to look to see where entities are willing to put their money to try to find, to help the shortage, to help Alaska with their provider shortages. And they get a tax benefit. Some of them can get a tax benefit if, let's say, if they're a private dentist, then those payments would be tax deductible for their business purposes as well.
Follow up.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to be specific on the question, is this legislation, this authority required to give them those tax benefits, or could they have gotten it again on their own through the federal government? So that's what I'm just asking, generically speaking. Do we need this for this to happen? And it may not happen without it, but was it something that was absolutely required for authority or those tax breaks, et cetera, to encourage them?
For the state of Alaska, through the chair, Senator Schauer, through recent authority needs to be established within statute to allow the department to receive these funds to be able to disperse them. So without the statute, the state would not be able to partake as described in our presentation.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Senator Machicki has a question.
So I believe it has tax protection in two directions, right? So the statute makes it a state loan repayment program under section 10908, and that makes it, please tell me correct me if I'm wrong, but it protects makes it a deductible for someone hiring the employee, and then it also makes the repayment where it's not a part of the income of the employee as well. So it's a deduction for those contributing to the program as an employer, and it's not counted as income for the employee for the loan repayment. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Maticki, mostly that's correct. It is definitely true that the healthcare professional, if and only if it is a state-run program, that is not considered income. And on that part only applies if you choose the loan repayment option. A direct incentive is taxable income. The tax benefit for the employer, it's not so much a tax benefit as it is a cost savings. So it's not really involving the IRS on their side of the equation. On their side of the equation, if they chose to do this on their own, let's say that they wanted to hire a Tier 2 professional, and that's $20,000 a year, and that was going to be $60,000. They want to incentivize that employee by giving them $60,000. But since that employee is now going to have to pay tax because the employer did it directly, they're going to have a huge tax burden on an extra $60,000 of income, extra on top of their income. And so the employee would be, it's very common for the employer to add on the extra 25-30%, you know, that it might be the 25% of tax. So they would get they'd have to pay more than $60,000 in order to give that employee the $60,000 incentive net. So for them, it's a matter of dollars and cents. It's not really their taxes that they get to deduct it on.
Senator Olson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you look at some of these, especially tier or sharp two, and you look at some of the incentives that are out there, I guess my question is, what happens to those medical professionals who already have their student loans paid off? How is there a way to go ahead and have them get this benefit of either an incentive or a supplement to their income?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the reason that we have a direct incentive built into this program is precisely for that. There are a great many mid-career professionals, and in particular, sometimes if you're going to work in a very rural area and maybe not have a lot of support systems around you, a brand new, newly graduated medical professional may not be your first choice. You might prefer to have someone more seasoned who may not have loans, and the direct incentive is available precisely for those folks and to attract them.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to move on to the sectional.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record again, this is Senator David Wilson. I will try to go through this as quick as I can. If you need more in-depth detail for each section, I can pause there if that will work here. Page one of the bill, section one, goes through pages 1 through 7. So we'll try to go through this. The first page of the bill covers the title, the legislative intent to increase availability of health services throughout the state of Alaska, especially the underserved individuals and health professional shortage areas, and covers the purpose of the bills, and that's through lines 1 through 14 on page 1, covers that area. On page 2, lines 1 through 12 outlines the structure of the program, including the application process, the public notice requirements, and the 12-year lifetime maximum for participation in the program. Page 2, lines 13 through 31 outlines the role of the structure of the advisory council, which is already established through SHARP 2. Page 3, going through lines 1 through 13, covers the outline of responsibility of the commissioner and his or her role and relationship with the advisory council. Page 3, lines 14 through 17 outlines the requirements of the department's annual report of the advisory council. Page 3, lines 18 through 22 specifies the departments may contract for services and adopt regulations, and this section here is for
put in place if the participation of outside providers get to a greater point, which is outside that one person's role currently in the department, that they may seek outside services to help administer the program. And
Senator Wilikowski.
On that point, if the department were to contract for any of those things, would that be done with the designated funds?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that would be done with all contracted funds outside of that. And that's also noted within the fiscal note as well.
Thank you.
Lines up on page 3, lines 24 through 31. And continuing to page 4, lines 1 through 4, details the requirement for the employer for payments. On page 4, lines 5 through 31, and continuing on page 5, lines 1 through 22, this establishes the structure of initial and renewal payments set out by the annual maximum for limits for the student loan repayments and the directives for tiers 1, 2, and 3. Page 5, lines 23 through 26, states that the eligible professionals may receive a direct incentive quarterly cash payments and employers to provide that payer amount. Lines 5, line 27, and continuing on page 6, lines 1 through 12, pertains to the student loan repayments. Page 6, lines 13 through 25 details the eligibility requirements for the directive incentive payments of the student loans. And beginning on page, also on page 6, lines 26 through 31, and continuing through page 8, lines 1, contains all the definition sections that goes to the eligibility, the employment payment, the program, what the qualified employment means, and goes through the tier sections and gives a detailed analysis of what an underserved individual is as well. And then on section 2, page 8, lines 2 through 4, repeals the existing healthcare loan repayment incentive programs, establishing AS 18.29.010 through 18.29.099, which is scheduled to sunset on July 1st of this year. Section 3, page 8, lines 5 through 9, details the applicability of applicants and contracts after July 1st of 2019. Section 4, page 8, lines 10 through 16, contains a language stating the existing advisory council will act in transition of the council into a new advisory council as appointed by the commissioner. Section 5, lines 8, I'm sorry, page 8, lines 17 through 20, states that Section 1 will take effect after July 19th of this act and is retroactive of July 1 of 2019. Section 6, line 21, states Section 5 will take effect immediately under AS 01.10.070, Section C. And page 8, line 22, is the other effective date of that. That ends that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Do we have any questions on the sectional? Senator Wilikowski.
Page 7, lines 23 through 25, defines Tier 3 healthcare professional as any person who's employed at an eligible site. Do you have any sense of what percentage of people who are receiving SHARP benefits now are Tier 3 healthcare professionals? And I guess I'm just curious what the rationale is for incentivizing, could be a janitor, could be someone, an accountant.
Again, for the record, this is Jill Lewis, Deputy Director for the Division of Public Health. Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, there are currently no Tier 3 contracts. This is brand new. With SB 93, we've never had a Tier 3. We had just Tier 1 and Tier 2 before. We expect that, and what we have heard from the employer community, are that mostly these will be healthcare professional jobs like occupational therapists, radiologic technologists, and other folks who have loan repayment but are not in the named list for Tier 1 and Tier 2. But it is open. If there is enough of a shortage that it needs a need to incentivize in order to provide health care, and it's not a direct care professional, it's a chief financial officer maybe, or even a CEO, or an accountant. If they can't find one and they want to incentivize one, then the council will weigh that application to see if it is indeed a shortage and is in the best interest of the state.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you both for presenting the intent of the bill and the sectional. I would like to open we have invited testimony from Ms. Rachel Gearhart, co-chair of the Sharp Advisory Council. Thank you, Ms. Gearhart. If you're ready, please state your name for the record and begin.
Thank you for having me. My name is Rachel Gearhart, and I've been a licensed clinical social worker in Alaska since 2008. I'm a member of the National Association of Social Workers Alaska chapter and serve as the Southeast Region representative to the board. And it's through my volunteer NASW service that I also volunteer to sit on the Sharp Council, where NASW is a voting member and I serve as the co-chair. And I'm also a constituent of Senator Jesse Heal in District Q, which is not considered a federally designated geographic health professional shortage area. And unless you work for the tribal health organization in town, you're not eligible for student loan repayment either through Sharp 1 or through another student loan repayment like National Health Service Corps. And so if you've heard me testify on this before, you know that I do my research. So Senator Stedman, looks like he stepped out, but Senator Stedman and Senator Von Imhoff, both of you do not live in geographic health professional shortage areas in Sitka or Anchorage. Senator Wilikowski, Senator Bishop, you guys do not either in Anchorage or Fairbanks. Senator Machicki, I appreciate you signing on as a co-sponsor in Kenai because I realize that you understand this would benefit your district as well in Kenai. Senator Schauer and Senator Wilson, part of your districts do qualify. Your whole area is a mental health geographic HPSA and only the upper Matsu for primary care and dental care. And then Senator Olson and Senator Hoffman, you guys do have geographic HPSAs, so I know you also understand how important this is because you do have that in your area. So speaking of HPSAs, as the sponsor of this bill, I really want to thank Senator Wilson for bringing this, and again for Senator Machicki for co-sponsoring. We have the opportunity to extend the same recruitment and retention opportunities to the whole state at no additional expenditures to the state, and it's time that we take it for good because we have dabbled in this arena before with Sharp 2, and I was one of those lucky recipients of Sharp 2, one of the 83 people who have been a recipient. And after already paying on my student loans for 7 years and after a 3-year Sharp 2 fee for service contract, I'm student loan debt free. And I'm still working at the same agency, and I've now lived in Alaska almost 13 years. So I got to pay off my student loans 20 years early, and I've certainly been retained. So those of us in this room cannot designate all of Alaska as a HPSA, but we can use Sharp 3 to recruit and retain quality staff to serve our vulnerable and underserved Alaskans. As the Senate Finance Committee, you might be interested to know that we get a fair amount of data from those quarterly work reports that's completed by the participants in the SHARP programs. We're able to track who works in primarily substance use capacities, which programs are full-time permanent positions that replace what was once filled by a costly locum tenens position. We learn important demographics that can be used for further recruitment and retention efforts, and all kinds of things like that. According to a study by the National Healthcare Retention and Registered Nurse Staffing Report, since 2013, the average hospital has turned over 85.2% of its workforce. And I think that we can all agree that Alaskan hospitals and healthcare providers are anything but average. The average cost of turnover across all occupations in the healthcare industry costs $60,000. Yet again, Alaskan is probably an outlier in that. Some reports estimate that replacing one physician costs at least $200,000 and as high as $1 million. So SHARP 3 will not only expand the eligible sites, but will also expand the professions. And I know that both Senator Wilson and Jill Lewis gave some possible occupations: respiratory therapists, occupational therapists, art therapists, case managers, certified nursing assistants, training coordinators, chemical dependency counselors, healthcare faculty members, phlebotomists, peer recovery coaches are all examples of included professionals working in the healthcare settings that can be included if they have qualified student loans and are working at eligible sites. And also, in many of those cases, those are lower cost employees that can help serve our clients at a lower billing rate than maybe a licensed practitioner. So it's very cost effective as well. In my line of work, the therapeutic alliance that you have with your client is considered the most important factor in how well you'll work together. It's not your age, it's not your gender, it's not where you were born, or whether you have children. Once our clients in primary care, dental care, and health care have high ACEs scores, years of trauma, and often comorbid conditions with co-occurring disorders start to connect with you, that's when we see progress. And when we see progress, we have better health outcomes. Disruptions in service delivery because of staff turnover that may be due to high cost of living is unavoidable. There was a 1998 study of developmental disability service providers in Alaska who contracted with the state, and 23 of 28 providers responded. And they were asked how much they spent on advertising, overtime with vacancies, recruitment, like fingerprinting, things like that, and training. And the average statewide cost per worker was $2,341 spent by turnover. And that was in 1988, so that was 20 years ago. Social work employment, for example, is projected to grow 16% by 2026. Faster than the average for all occupations. And just also to give a very Alaskan example, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs employs more than 12,000 professional social workers across the United States. Social work is the largest group of mental health care providers in the United States. So there's certainly a need here. SHARP 3 support for service helps all Alaskans live their own best lives. And as a provider who works with the underserved population in a non-HPSA location, as a SHARP alum, and as a SHARP Council co-chair, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions from committee members for Ms. Gearhart? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the right witness or not, but I'm just curious how this, is this a tax on every healthcare provider in the state, or how much is that, and how is that determined? Do you know that?
Senator, through the chair, if I'm understanding your question correctly, this is totally voluntary. So some employers may choose not to use SHARP at all, and employers that will choose to use SHARP, it levels the playing field a bit for other agencies. There are and will continue to be large employers that will use sign-on bonuses, will use student loan repayments for recruitment and retention efforts. And not all agencies have that availability. This levels the playing field a bit in that more rural, smaller agencies can use that. It sets a cap at what the maximum can be given to any employee is. And because it doesn't require any state general funds, where they get the money from is maybe their own agency, but they can also partner with agencies in town, can partner with the city of Valdez, for example, can partner with, foundations. Does that answer your question?
Maybe at some point, Madam Chair, if we could get
Senator Wilikowski follow-up.
Yeah, if I could see some layout of how this is administered, if it's every hospital pays a small amount, or I'm just curious how it works.
I think it sounds like it's voluntary, but Ms. Gearhart, if you want to get back to the committee about and work with the bill sponsor in regards to the sources of the funding,
of course, sure.
I think would be fine.
The administrative fee that we've talked about in these is generally considered, and it will go into regulation, is 5%, and that 5% would help fund the program. We're happy to give you more information.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Olson, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gearhart, as you look at the program, what percentage of it is is effective, and what do you see as the most effective part of it?
So, Senator Olson, through the chair, I did not bring all my graphs with me, but we can absolutely provide these graphs with you about retention throughout the state. We have, and I think Senator Wilson referenced the SHARP 2 report. We have reports on SHARP 1 as well. So SHARP 1 is a little more restrictive about who participated in what parts of the state. SHARP 2 expanded that and served 83 professionals. But between SHARP 1 and SHARP 2, we've served 328 different contracts throughout the years that this has participated. And so we do have data on retention at site or within Alaska, both of those. We
so SHARP 1 is more restrictive because it's federal funded?
Yes, federally funded. Because those people have to work in a geographic health professional shortage area.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Bishop?
Oh, just a comment. I've been sitting here for, what, an hour listening to this, and I just have to chuckle to myself. It's good, but it's basically an apprenticeship program without a registered apprenticeship program, and it's a voluntary assessment on the employers, and it is 5%, but after year three, it increases to 6.5 as you continue the education, as the program grows, which that's fine. I like it.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. So, Ms. Gearhart, if you could just stick around in the room, at least, we do have, I'd like to open up to public testimony, simply because we've had two folks here waiting online for quite a while. But in the event that there are other questions following the public testimony, I'd like to invite you back to the bench just to answer those in case we need them. So thank you very much. So at this time, I would like to open public testimony on SB 93. I do see two very patient people that have been online for quite some time. I have first with Eric Boyer with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Mr. Boyer, could you please state your name and begin your testimony?
Yes. For the record, my name is Eric Boyer. I'm a program officer for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Thank you to Co-Chair Von Imhoff and Co-Chair Stedman and the Senate Finance Committee for hearing this bill today. The Trust is very interested in seeing Senate Bill 93 get passed, as we have invested in the first two iterations of this bill, called SHARP 1 and 2, for over 10 years, with an investment totaling over $2 million. This program is important because it has helped recruit and retain clinicians all over the state, tribal and non-tribal, in the amount of 328 contracts since inception. Since it is the duty of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority to provide leadership in the advocacy, planning, implementing, and funding of services and programs for trust beneficiaries, it is understandable that we support Senate Bill 93, as it will expand our beneficiaries' access to health care services. Senate Bill 93 is an innovative project that, without the use of general fund dollars, allows for private-public collaboration in the funding of tax-free student loan repayments or direct incentives. Senate Bill 93 will expand on the current SHARP system in terms of occupation types as well as locations in Alaska that can take advantage of this program, meaning more trust beneficiaries will be able to get necessary care in their community of residence. Thank you. Appreciate this time.
Thank you, Mr. Boyer, for your testimony. Do we have any questions by committee members? Next, we have Ms. Nancy Merriman, Alaska Primary Care Associates.
Good morning, Co-Chair Stedman and Von Imhoff, and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Merriman. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association. The Alaska Primary Care Association supports the operations and development of Alaska's 27 community health center organizations. Together with the leaders of the community health centers in this state, we strongly support Senate Bill 93 to establish the SHARP 3 program. I'd like to highlight three particular points about how this legislation will help health centers better serve Alaskans. Point number one, there is a shortage of health professionals of all types in Alaska. Health center leaders constantly grapple with vacant healthcare clinician positions in their clinics. And although healthcare jobs remain the fastest growing sector in the Alaska labor force, the demands are outpacing the availability. Alaskans are growing older, needing more health care. There's an increasing incidence of chronic disease requiring more constant care, and healthcare professionals are not distributed evenly across the state. Point number two, SHARP and other loan repayment programs have been critical for community health centers. Since its inception in 2010, the SHARP 1 program has issued 172 contracts to health centers, and SHARP 2 issued 47. 140 medical, 43 dental, and 36 behavioral health professionals have been placed in health centers. Without fail, when APCA surveys health centers and asks what the most important workforce issues are, it's all about recruitment and retention and how much they've appreciated SHARP. And SHARP's been able to address some of the disparity in distribution of providers, placing them from Anchorage to Juneau, Norton Sound, YK, the Kenai Peninsula, and out the chain to Dutch Harbor. The SHARP Support for Service Program, including loan repayment and longevity payments, has made a tremendously positive difference in health centers' ability to attract and retain quality, qualified healthcare professionals in these critical positions. Point number three, SHARP 3 is innovative and requires no state general fund dollars to replace the state-funded program. SHARP 3 will offer a valuable state infrastructure without additional state general funds and will provide the ability to expand the benefits of SHARP to areas that are not health professional shortage areas, a requirement for SHARP 1, as well as expand the provider types that are eligible for loan repayment. Alaska's community health centers are prepared to utilize SHARP 3 as soon as it becomes available. We're eager to continue the momentum of SHARP and to support workforce development efforts in Alaska. APCA and community health centers appreciate the SHARP Council's innovative thinking in contributing to the solutions of the healthcare workforce shortage issues in Alaska. With SHARP 3 being privately funded, loan repayment and longevity incentives can be expanded to more practitioner types, more clinical sites across Alaska. This will greatly increase the number and variety of health professionals and sites like community health centers who participate. Thank you for your time, and please see our letter of support for more details.
Thank you, Ms. Merriman, for your testimony. Is there anyone else signed up? Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 93? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Oh God, that thing's heavy. Okay, does the committee have any further questions or discussion on the bill? We have, as you recall, Rachel Gerhardt and Joe Lewis here. Okay. Senator Machicki.
Just a question for Jill, if that's okay. I want to clarify something for myself, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Jill, for coming to the table.
So SHARP 2, and I know we're going to go over the fiscal note, that was state, it looks like, of the 83 positions, 76,680 each, the state paid almost $5 million and the employers spent about $1.45 million. This program has no state funds included at all, right? And the 5% fee is only the contract fee for those that choose to participate. That increases to 6.5% in year five, and that's to cover the one position currently and the one that you're going to add. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, that is correct. It is entirely voluntary. There's no cost to employers unless they choose to participate. Okay. Hire someone and offer them this incentive. There's no requirement that they offer the incentive to the healthcare professionals that they hire either. You have to find two willing participants, the employee and the employer, who are willing to enter into this contractual relationship together.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. So I'd like to address the fiscal note at this time. Senator Stedman, would you please no, you're not going to review the fiscal note.
Just see if you're paying attention, Madam Chairman.
Okay.
We have two fiscal notes before the committee today. First one is from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. The appropriation is for the corporation's business and professional licensing, along with the allocation of corporation businesses and professional licensing in the OMB component number is 2360. That fiscal note, Madam Chairman, is zero. The second fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services, the appropriations to the public and under public health, the allocation to emergency programs, and the OMB component number is 2877. And excuse me, the data on this is 4/05/2019, along with the previous fiscal note is dated the same date also. That fiscal note has $814,300 in FY20, and then we go on to FY21 of $2,060,000 rounded off, 22, $2,615,000, and up to $3,220,000 rounded off, and then up to $4,041,000 rounded off, and then in FY25, $5,043,000 rounded off. But it's important to note that these are designated general funds, so it's, as referenced earlier by Senator Michicki, it doesn't have a budgetary impact. It's more or less pass-through monies, so it doesn't affect the growth in government that we're trying to control, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Any discussion on the fiscal note? Senator Michicki.
Yeah, I just think that's important, and that's what the struggle's been about for us, is the administration's been lumping those together, and clearly this has no impact on the bottom line of the state. It's paid for from outside, and it's dollars that are going outside. Although you can see it in the budget, it's not a part of what we're responsible for, Madam Chair, and I just think that's important for the public to understand.
Thank you, Senator Michicki, for that clarification. We will set SB 93 aside for further review. Please let my office know as soon as possible if you have any concerns or amendments. Senator Wilson, did you want to have a closing comment?
I did, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the committee again for the opportunity and urge committee members to review the sort of the final report of the SHARP II program, which gives the basis of this new program and their final recommendations of where to go next. And, you know, I personally did not want to run this bill without sort of hearing from commitments from entities on the financial component. I didn't want to build a program and they never come. I wanted to hear from certain funders to say yes, and I think those statements of intent are within the packet as well, to say that there are providers that are willing to pay that have reached out to my office. I know that they've reached out to another senator's office last year on their encouragement, saying that we will put forth the dollars for this program. And so that's something I'll say, is wanting to get on the record that we weren't just going to try to build a program and let them come. We want to make sure that those dollars would be there first.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Senator Michicki.
Yeah, just one follow-up for Ms. Lewis, and that was typically, this is really kind of indeterminate. Isn't this just sort of for illustrative purposes, because we have no idea what the demand is going to be of the program. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, it definitely is an estimate. It's based on some of our experience with SHARP II and what we saw for Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 3 in particular is an estimate, since we have never done that before. That's true.
Thank you, Senator Michicki, for pointing out that, yes, in the out years, after years 4 and 5, it does become an estimate. So we will set Senate Bill 93 aside for further review. Please let me know if you have any questions or amendments. That concludes today's meeting. Our next meeting will be tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We will be discussing SB 103, the PFD appropriations, which is the POMV split bill. Exciting times. SB 104, the appropriation limit, a spending cap. Can't wait. We are all adjourned.